You know, my former spouse, Becky, just recently lost her father. And it's been a tough time for her because in a very short period of time here, she's lost both her mom and her dad. And that's an event you cannot control. And God knows we tried. You know, 3 years ago when they told us that her father had cancer, they told us that he would die within a period of anywhere from 3 to 6 months. And we just did not allow them to tell him that. For the obvious reasons, you know what, I believe from all the people we've learned from everyone from Dr. Bernie Siegel to Norman Cousins to Dr. Deepak Chopra, we understand the mind-body connection. If someone decides that because they have some dis-ease in their body, what it means is they're going to die, then of course they will. And fortunately, he never found out that diagnosis. And what we did is we kept making sure he had a compelling future. He had a sense of meaning, a variety of things that he was needed for. And it was amazing how he physically responded. We had a trip scheduled for him to go to Fiji on, which he went on, and talked to him about how we needed his help with our resort there and helping some of the Fijians in the garden, because the garden for him created so much meaning in his life. It's about supporting, about nurturing, about helping life along a little bit. And so that he was excited about, and things we wanted him to do with his grandkids. And so we kept giving him compelling futures, and sure enough, 3 months went by, he was healthy, 6 months went by, he was healthy, a year went by. And through a variety of interventions, pretty soon he seemed to be better, until just recently when we started getting phone calls from his neighbors. He lived up in a place called Rand, Colorado, a little town with 14 people in it that he's been a major part of for years and years. And they started to call us to tell us that they didn't think he could take care of himself anymore, so we flew out and brought him back here. And in the first few days, he was in phenomenal shape. It was like he was completely restored, being around the grandkids and being in the environment. He was all excited to share about things that happened in his little town of Rand that he helped to create there, about all about the calves that he helped to deliver, and about the planting season and how they're helping people through the winter and some of the stories they've been telling. And he was just totally alive. And we took him to doctors for a series of tests. They said they wanted to keep him overnight. The next day we called and I spoke to his main doctor, and he said it looks like he just has a form of meningitis. So he said that'll be really easily treatable and he should be okay. And he said, don't worry. He said, we're just going to do a series of more tests because he's a bit dehydrated. He lives at an altitude of about 11,500 feet, and he's not drinking enough water. And he said, so, you know, we're going to run a couple more tests, he said, next day. He said, but I think he'll be fine. He said, I have to go out of town. He said, my, you know, partner doctor will be working with him. So he said, I've passed on all the information. You can check in with him tomorrow. Well, the next day, Becky went to go see her dad, and I was out doing a seminar. And I got a phone call, and the phone call was that they'd done additional tests and that they'd found out that the cancer had spread throughout his spine and into his brain. And while it wasn't treatable before, when they told us 3 years ago, it's certainly not treatable now, and that they thought he would die within weeks. The worst part was, though, that they also told this to him before they told it to Becky. So he had no one there to support him through the process or to give him other options. When I found this out, I became so angry with the doctors because I focused on how he had violated what we asked him to do and how the other doctor should have told his partner doctor not to tell him yet, to allow us to talk to him, to prepare him for the situation. That it was so harsh, it was so unfair, and the meaning of it was that it was going to really harm him, that all of a sudden he would give up hope. And what I wanted to do was lash out, and fortunately I didn't lash out. Instead, I started to focus on what's happening to Cecil, what can I do? So I went to go see him and talk to him, and it was unbelievable. He looked like he just aged 10 years in a day. Because what had happened is he had no future. There was no purpose in fighting the pain or trying to make things happen or, you know, trying to tell stories or do anything, because after all, you're going to die anyway soon. And that was kind of the way he was interpreting it. And sure enough, no matter what we said, he just didn't seem to respond. He just seemed to go into a total stupor. And for the next day and a half or so, he just sat in a corner. And he really didn't say very much or communicate very much. He just said not to bother with him, that he was fine. But he didn't open up emotionally. And I just sat down with him, and I cried, and I told him how much I loved him and how much Becky loved him and how he needed to share with us what he was really feeling, because, you know, holding that back wasn't protecting us from pain. We just felt separate from him, that he could choose what this was going to mean for his life. The doctors had told us 3 years ago that he was going to die within a matter of months then. And here he was 3 years later. I said, what if you would have just sat around for 3 years in this little corner doing nothing because you thought you were going to die any day or any week? I said, that'd be pretty crazy, huh? And he started to laugh. I said, look at this. I said, you can't just sit off in this corner. Hey, you might die tomorrow. You might die in 6 weeks. You might die in 6 months. You might die in 6 years. You might die in 10 or 20 years and really screw these people's brains up. I said, it doesn't matter how long you're going to live. What's going to matter is how you're going to live while you're here. And I said, you've lived an incredible life. In World War II, you were a pilot, you know. You were a businessman. Now you're this guy who's touching this little town up in Colorado where everybody knows you and cares about you and loves you because you love them. I said, you've raised these incredible kids. I said, you know, if you're going to go out in style. Go out because you decided to go out in an energy that you want to, where you really enjoy your life. Don't just shut down because somebody told you your life's over because you buy into it. Don't do it. And then he said, well, you know, Tony, he said, the truth is I'm not afraid to die. And he said, everything you said is true. He said, you know, my life has been so rich. And he says, I feel like, you know, I've lived my purpose now. You know, I look around and I see my kids and I see what they're like as people and I see what I've done and I think maybe it's time for me to go now. I said, listen, if you're deciding to do that because you really want to go, I said, then, you know, I love you. I mean, he said, you know, I'm going to cry and I'm not going to try and keep you here and neither is Beck because we love you. I said, but at the same time, don't leave because somebody tells you it's time to go. He said, well, I don't know. I said, well, when it's time to go, you'll know. I said, and you can go consciously. You can decide when it's time. You don't have to wait till the pain is so intense you can't stand it. But at the same time, don't go any quicker than your meeting is done. I think right now you're teaching your family a lot of new lessons. He said, yeah, that's probably true. I said, so what do you want to do? How do you want to do things? I said, let's get your fanny out of here. Let's get about. And we had this great conversation and talked about all kinds of things. I won't bore you with the details, but I let him know that he never had to worry about his daughter and that she had become the kind of person he could always be proud of. And it was amazing because the next 3, 4, 5 days he came to life. All of a sudden, there was a purpose in things again. All of a sudden, he was alive. He'd go out by the pool and tell stories and so forth. And he went over to the polo grounds and did all kinds of just really great things. And then I went away for a seminar, and I came back 2 days later, and it was like he was gone. He could barely even talk. He's having a difficult time holding himself up. We had to have round-the-clock care for him. Pretty soon, he wasn't able to carry on a conversation. He would start talking gibberish and start seeing things that were invisible and point to them. And we could tell the end was coming. And as the end started to come, there was more and more pain and tears. And we felt it all. And I also, at the same time, reminded ourselves that, hey, we're making this thing that it's lost because of our short-term thinking about this man and his body and his presence, but his life will live on beyond his physical presence here. And for him, what it probably means is freedom. Finally be free of the painful body he's been in for so many years. For him, it's a chance to be with his wife, Becky's mom. Chance to be with other loved ones. There was another meaning that could give you joy at the same time you're feeling pain. And so we try to focus on those. And then one night I got home and all of a sudden I was called by the nurse. And she told me that Becky's dad had just passed away. I had to share it with Beck, and we cried and we talked, and at the same time, she felt an incredible sense of peace for him. It's amazing how instantly how we felt could change just by changing what we focused on, from our loss to his gain, to the feeling of joy for him to be free. We couldn't control the event, but we could certainly direct our own minds by thinking beyond ourselves to something deeper. A deeper meaning in life. I got back yesterday from going with Becky up to this little town in Rand, Colorado. This little town I'd never been to before, but Becky had been there many times, and I got a chance to see where Cecil lived and the impact he had. He didn't really want a funeral. He never liked people who, quote, put on airs for anything. He was a simple man with simple values and a simple mission. And when I got there, I looked around and he never explicitly said what the mission of his life was, the purpose of his life. But in a town of 14 people, and we went out to this gravesite to put his body into the ground, and suddenly person after person started showing up. We knew all 14 people would be there because we knew he'd touch them all. They all loved him. He was the storyteller. He was the man who took an old car years ago and painted it black and white and put a star on the side and put a dumb in the inside of glasses and made it look like a police car so that people came running through this little town, which consists of about 7 or 8 buildings, that they might slow down. His house was called the Rand Yacht Club because he invited everybody up for coffee every single morning, at least 300 days a year. Figured out how he could tell them a story and cheer them up. He used to run a little restaurant there called the Liar's Lair. The reason was because he had people, he'd tell people stories, and he'd tell the wildest tales and get people to believe them. Sure enough, after about 10 or 15 years, they began to realize that some of these things were stories. And they all laughed as they told me stories about this incredible man who touched their lives. But when we got to the gravesite, not only did 14 people show up, but in this little town that's 4 hours outside of Denver, people came from all over. People came from Wyoming. People came from Denver. Pretty soon there were 100 people at a gravesite where there was not supposed to be a service to honor a man who touched their lives. So we said, you know, we don't have any formal service because that's not what he wanted, but before we put his body in the ground, does anybody like to say anything? And they all talked about how he touched them, how their life was greater because he was such a loving soul, that his smile had touched them, that his stories had touched them, that just his manner, that he was a lover of people and animals, that because he'd been in this town, their lives would never be the same. And people who'd come through the town just for a day, just his little kindness. He was a man who said, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. He never said a negative word about anybody. In fact, one man, probably the most telling tale of this man's life, he said, Cecil's the kind of guy, he said, I sat down one day with him and said, what are you doing about all those rodents that keep stealing all our animals? Are you poisoning them? Or are you shooting them? Are you trapping them? Are you killing them? What are you doing? He said, because they're taking all my stuff. And Cecil said, no, he said, I just plant twice as much. I thought, what a life. What a man. See, his life was his mission. His mission was real simple. Love people, love animals, love beings. Make the world a little bit better by just being nice. He lived a life of significance, one that had meaning. He didn't go out and change everything on earth. He didn't make $1 billion. He doesn't have people writing him up everywhere, but he changed people's lives. And he died in his sleep, out of pain, the day he decided to go. And he created in his family a greater sense of courage to look at life in a new way, and a greater sense of dedication to give even more. He added to our drive. He added to our commitment to be givers in life, as he was to any soul who had the privilege of coming across his path. I hope it also makes you think about what's most important in your life. I remember an interview with Michael Landon in Life magazine when he knew he was going to go. And he said, quote, somebody should tell us right at the start of our life that we're dying, that we might live life to the limit, every minute of every day. Do it, I say. Whatever you want to do, do it now. There are only so many tomorrows. If you and I are going to live our lives fully, then maybe sometimes we can take the experiences of those around us and learn from them. We can learn that in all of our lives we're either warnings or examples. Cecil's life was an incredible example. He didn't think anything in life was insignificant. Not a rodent, not a flower, not an animal, not a stranger passing through. He lived by a philosophy that they also live in Fiji. By the way, Fiji was his favorite place. One of the last things he told me was the happiest time of his life, the last few years, were the trips he took to Fiji. I think it's because he felt like there everybody understood what he understood. And life is meant to be a happy, to be a joy, to appreciate the little things as well as the big things, to appreciate one another, to be givers, to be lovers of life.